Good afternoon, and thank you for having me here for such an important topic. It's great to be here. Over the last few years, there's been significant disruption, and as you know, we've all suffered through a once-in-a-generation pandemic. We've had interest rates increase in the fastest in a generation. We've got a cost-of-living crisis, ongoing geopolitical uncertainties, and the ever reminding impacts of climate change. And with respect to climate change in particular, we know that's going to take a concerted effort from all of us to hit net zero, and we're going to have our net zero transition plans. But one thing that's really apparent is that we're not going to be able to decarbonise and hit net zero without a change in our economic model from the linear take, make and waste type model that is currently employed today to a far more circular model, which is to reuse, recycle and repurpose, etc. A circular economy is only sustainable if it is more productive than the previous economic model. And importantly, circularity for the purposes only of decarbonisation may not necessarily mean it is more economic or more productive. And by way of example, to replace carbon-intensive machinery of the economy with more carbon-neutral alternatives may not necessarily be more productive, may be less economic and therefore less sustainable. And one of the things that's really important is that we factor into our supply chains the true cost of our consumption and the negative externalities associated with that consumption, whether that be loss of biodiversity, carbon emissions, or in fact just general waste. And once we embed within our supply chains that true cost, we can incentivize new investment in technology and new business models that will ultimately try to remove those costs, reduce them, leading to more productive outcomes, more sustainable outcomes, and ultimately a more circular economy. And therefore, circularity, for me, can be the solution to Australia's productivity problem going forward. In an ideal world, we would utilise or reuse all of the natural resources and raw materials we mine. At the moment, the world's economy has a circularity rate of something in the order of 7.25%, which means roughly more than 90% of our materials are ultimately wasted. And you know, what does that mean? It means we need to to continue to actually support our wasteful consumption. We need to continue to mine for natural resources and raw materials. Now, one staggering statistic is that approximately 50% of the world's GDP, or $45 trillion of the world's GDP, is highly dependent on nature and biodiversity. And so to the extent that we continue to disrupt nature and biodiversity to extract raw materials, clearly there is some significant, it's not sustainable, and there's some significant benefits and potential costs to the extent that we don't necessarily move and move fast. In Australia alone, approximately a third, we're the third highest consuming nature country of materials per capita in the world. So it's a problem that's very live and real here in this particular country. The good news is where circularity does make sense from a productive nature, it is being deployed. And a good example is in the waste sector. Visy has a good example where they go and collect glass and cardboard and paper from supermarkets, reprocess this material into packaging. Ultimately, that packaging has a far lower carbon intensity and also avoids having to import key products such as soda ash used as supply or goes as an input into glass, which obviously carries emissions associated with that freight. And this is a very good example of where circularity equals or coexists with productivity. And ultimately, if we use reuse many of our core materials, that ultimately will drive more resilient supply chains and lead to increased jobs. A recent study suggested that, you know, if we were to really embrace circularity by 2000 or somewhere as close to 2025, we could unlock something like $23 billion of economic value within Australia and employ have tens of thousands of jobs created as a result. At a global scale, that number is about $4.5 trillion by 2030. So therefore, the prize very much is worth fighting for. In some countries, they're very advanced in the way they think about circularity. I'm sure you've heard about the Netherlands through the course of this particular conference. I think they're at a 25% circularity rate, targets of 50% by 2030 and 100% by 2050. We see the opportunity as large. It's going to take the collective effort across government, financial services, businesses large and small, as well as the consumer, to make it happen. There's no doubt challenges, which I'll come to in a minute, but to the extent that we can spawn brand new industries, new jobs and new skills, this is definitely a prize that's worth fighting for. Consumers themselves are already very socially aware of waste and are taking real steps to do that, but to minimise waste, but they need the businesses that they buy products from to equally have awareness around their own operating model and their own supply chains to help reduce waste. Investors certainly understand that. According to the Global Impact Investing Network, impact investing or so-called ethical investing surpassed $1 trillion last year in Australia alone. That number had increased over the last year from about $30 billion to $60 billion. But circularity is a broad concept, difficult to understand and very hard for businesses to actually interact. So there needs to be continued work in educating those businesses in how best to do that. But there are already very good examples through Australia of where that exists. And for example, Patagonia has targets by 2025 to use 100% recycled or renewable materials in the apparel industry. GSK has zero environmental waste targets, including the removal of single-use plastics by 2030. And Microsoft aims to use 90% reuse servers and componentry in its regional data centres by 2025. As it relates to CBA specifically, we've got two roles to play. Firstly, as a good corporate citizen, we are committed to removing emissions and removing our scope 1 and 2 and ultimately minimising our environmental footprint. Since 2014, we've removed or reduced our scope 1 and 2 emissions by 95%, and last year we deployed 100% renewable electricity across our global property footprint. We also use design principles in terms of understanding how to minimise waste through our large office and branch network. We've got one of the largest property footprints in Australia, and therefore design principles around energy, air quality, waste, as well as water are really, really important. We try to, in our offices, repurpose as much equipment as we possibly can. We focus on compost through the office footprint. We use recycled water, and we continue to focus on digitisation to remove paper that ultimately would end up in landfill. By way of example, our Commonwealth Bank place headquarters, which was recently renovated over in Darling Park Quarter, we've repurposed 80% of the ceiling and floor access areas. We've about 10 kilometres of pipe and duct work. We've refurbished the chilled beam air conditioning system for greater efficiencies. And we've also repurposed 95% of our office chairs, as well as 50% of our workstations. We use a green building tool based on our design principles that we share with our clients, that helps them then engage with sustainable design principles in their own property footprint to either reduce emissions or reduce waste in general. The second area where CBA plays a role is as a financial service provider. And importantly, we access capital across the economy to areas that hopefully drive greater sustainability and ultimately economic value. We use tools such as green bonds, green loans, sustainability-linked loans to help incentivise the right behaviours that are going to drive good economic outcomes as it relates to these areas. By way of example, we financed Pact Group, one of Australia's leading packaging companies, and a sustainability-linked loan is north of $400 million financing. And the margin on this loan linked to four key areas. First one was, increasing the recycled materials in packed packaging. The second one was using more recycled packaging and materials and providing that to the external market. The third one was reducing scope 1 and 2 emissions. And the fourth one is around gender pay equality. We sold bank finance the Circular Plastics Australia, which is a PET plastics recycling facility. And then the most recent example, providing Crown Infrastructure partners down in New Zealand with north of $200 million New Zealand dollars to build a sludge minimisation facility, which would be constructed in Wellington as part of their sewage and waterworks infrastructure that the Mayor says will reduce sludge within Wellington by up to 80% per annum. And so we see many business opportunities across broader the economy. And as you heard me speak a little bit earlier, nature makes up about 50% of the world's GDP, and therefore preserving nature is really important. And where we see most of the business opportunities, areas that can protect this nature. And I'd classify that in the construction industry, food and agri, and then food and beverage. Now, in the construction industry, in order to hit net zero, there's got to be enormous use of materials such as cement, steel and aluminium, which are all very carbon-intensive materials. And, things like scrap steel recycling and using other materials in building are going to be really, really important initiatives in terms of driving net zero. A good example is one of our clients called Hallett Group in South Australia that has a green concrete transformation project where it uses industrial waste as input to provide green cement. In terms of agri, we've seen a 200% uptake in our Agri Green Loan, which is an instrument designed to encourage sustainable farming over the course of the last year. And I think a very good example of circularity at work within in the agri food space is around sugar. Sugar cane ultimately is processed to produce sugar. The waste materials of that are used to create renewable electricity. The sugar itself can be turned into ethanol or fertiliser that can be reused on the crops. And then and ultimately into a food group if needed, as we all know too well. And then ultimately, the renewable electricity is then reused in the old mills, giving them another lease on life. And then the final area is really around the packaging around the food and beverage area. I mentioned the Visy example a little bit earlier, but and that's an area where it actually makes great productive sense to use it, and where it is productive, that industry is using it. But there are other examples where the economics actually don't make sense, and so aluminium is a good example. I mean, the cost of collecting aluminium cans, sorting them, transporting them offshore, reprocessing them offshore, bringing them back down for the creation of aluminium cans. At the moment, the cost of that process is actually greater than the value that is ascribed to the end product. And that happens across many different products at the moment. If I think about plastics as an example, the cost of recycling plastic is still far greater than using virgin resin to create plastic, which is ultimately based on fossil fuels. And so, the economics of these industries ultimately has to change. I think in Australia, we generate something in the order of 2.6 million tonnes of plastic a year. About a third of that is recoverable. Now, of the 350,000 tonnes of plastic that is recoverable, about a third of that is reprocessed in Australia. And the CSIRO says that to reprocess, to avoid increased plastic going into landfill, we have to increase our reprocessing capacity in Australia, something in the order of 150%. Globally, the UN expects material and investment in material recycling and reprocessing is something like a $1 trillion economy by 2025. So supporting our key businesses using sustainable finance, allocating capital to the right areas is a very big initiative for CBA. But importantly, we cannot do it alone. It needs to be coordinated, and there are obviously key areas where we need help that are currently barriers. And probably the first one is in funding. As I mentioned just before, there are still many areas where it doesn't make economic sense to invest in the technology. And that's where we need private philanthropic capital. We also need government concessional capital. In the context of climate change, that looks like the CEFC, Rewiring the Nation Fund, ARENA, to name a few examples, where it's important that private capital like banks and superannuation funds have the ability to partner with these pools of capital, and they have the ability to crowd us in as opposed to crowd us out and compete, so we can get maximum scale, ultimately to drive the scalable finance solutions that we need to drive the circular economy. I think the other really important part is continued development of carbon and environmental markets. I mentioned this at the outset. These play two roles. The first role is it's a way of funneling capital into important initiatives that are ultimately going to drive investment in more circular and sustainable types of initiatives. And a good example can be soil carbon. Where carbon markets are currently funneling capital to, ultimately this has the ability to extract carbon from the universe, store it in the soil, but that ultimately can drive greater crop yield and therefore greater efficiency and productivity. But the other important thing about these markets is they provide a price point by which we can put a cost on our supply chains. And again, by putting that cost on the supply chains, we put a cost on the consequences of our consumption that then invites the technology that can ultimately drive more investment. And then the final barrier or the final area where we need work is really around regulation and policy. It's clear that business has to be talking closely with government. We need a very good competition framework so government and business and other businesses can collaborate, which is important. We need consistency across state and federal government policy. And we need good policy roadmaps with good targets in place. So in summary, business has to play a role in driving a circular economy. It needs education and it needs a top-down approach, and that's where the board of directors come in, which is really important. We think there's $1.8 trillion of GDP benefit over the next 20 years and something in the order of 165 million tonnes of carbon emissions to be avoided if we get this right. We cannot do it alone. We all need to do it together, customer, business, government and investors. And then finally, if we do get this right, I think circularity can actually be the solution to Australia's productivity problem. Thank you very much for having me and enjoy the rest of the conference.
But we're going to kick things off talking about how do we take these theoretical notions and how do we integrate conversations around planetary boundaries, financing, and design. So we've heard lots and lots of talk over the last day and a half about systems. How are we going to connect the narratives across those systems and apply it in tangible, practical ways, in the ways we need to see the transformation that we're seeking? So the elephant in the room, I think we've probably heard a bit of this over the last couple of days. We know we've got some significant carbon challenges. Australia is one of those countries that is a very high emitter, a very big consumer. And I think somebody mentioned yesterday that if everyone consumed the way Australia did, we would need four planet Earths, which clearly we don't have. So planetary boundaries. I was lucky to attend the World Circular Economy Forum with the ICE Hub crew in May, June this year. And this is what we heard a lot of. Pricing externalities, planetary boundaries, triple planetary crisis, and how do we connect the dots across systems to incorporate these serious challenges in our built environment conversations, in our food and ag conversations. So this planetary boundary discussion is getting stronger and stronger, and Europe is not afraid to take those levers that they've already applied for carbon and apply them for circular metrics, sustainable finance, and all of the other things that trading nations can use as levers for change. So if we look at, take those challenges of carbon and other issues that we've got going on, the built environment is a big, big part of the problem, and therefore it needs to be a big, big part of the solution. So one of the things that we've already heard talk about, and our previous speaker mentioned it, is we've got this trend in carbon. We're going to just take carbon as an example. We've got this trend going up. We've got these massive aspirational goals and targets to drive that down. We've got net zero by 2050. Some companies are 2030. So we're seeing, you know, lots of words and lots of narratives. But the other part of that equation is going in the wrong direction. Now, some of you may remember, if you were here yesterday, you would have heard Yanis Potocnik talking about the built environment. And if you can remember, he had two columns, you know, a nice green column, which is basically all of the biomass on the planet. 0.01% of that is humans. And then it had this enormous column beside it, which was the built environment. And we're about to add two more of those by 2040. So you can clearly see that there is a disconnect between what we're trying to achieve and the plans we have to go in the other direction for growth. And some of those countries need to grow. They need hospitals, they need libraries, they need schools, they need infrastructure. So if that's the case, how do we connect the dots across these significant challenges? So what my co-presenter Tim's going to talk about is how we are trying to take that all of those challenges and apply them in a practical way to how we can change the form of the built environment. So I'm going to hand over to Tim and let him talk through the next few slides, which is going to be quite fascinating.
Thank you so much, Debbie. And I want you to just keep that last number in the top of your mind, because this disconnect between what we want to do legislatively and what we actually do is where the rubber hits the road for us as engineering consultants in the built environment. You just heard Andrew talk a lot about true costs. You also talked about construction and the building materials that make up a lot of the carbonisation of our economy. And what we're doing is trying to seek tangible mechanisms to begin to reverse that and value it at the same time. So you would probably be a little bit surprised to know that we, as a engineers of built engineering environments, as well as architects, we genuinely have these sort of three design choices generally at any given point on any given project. And there's three sort of avenues that we can take. We sort of don't think about carbon or any of the planetary boundaries whatsoever or circularity, or we manually calculate it. So we might have quantity surveyors that take the bill of materials as a good example and then look up LCAs as a good example, all very manual and very disconnected from the actual design process. Or we might have sort of top-down calculations, which is generally runs alongside but is generally quite vague once it comes into the design choices and the semantics of what we're actually designing. And so there's this kind of beautiful question about, is this the perfect instrument, the perfect storm to make better decisions about the built environment, which make up 40% of our carbon? And so we, along with our colleagues Planet Price, have been challenging ourselves and throwing a lot of investment at solving this design problem, where we have bottoms-up estimates on carbon and all the planetary boundaries and monetize them and do it automatically. And the exam question that we've set ourselves is, can we design something and then estimate its carbon and visualize it in less than 2 hours? And I'm proud to say that we've done that. So let's talk a little bit about how we do that. And there's many roads to Rome, which is fantastic. So here is a bridge. We do a lot of them. They make up massive portions of carbon in our economy, and we drive across hundreds of them in a year, and they stand for many, often hundreds of years. But for every tonne of cement that we put in, it's a tonne of CO2. And we throw tonnes of cement at these things. And so the question then becomes, how do we attribute certain design elements to those components that we put on the bridge? So we tell those assets what they are, and we do that using object-based design. And there's a lot of automation then to connect the design elements, as a good example, to LCAs, as a good example, and not just carbon LCAs, but also other planetary boundaries. And then from there, we can colourise it. So we can walk our clients, as a good example, through their new investment, and they can see the carbon that they're just about to purchase, or they can see the ocean oxidisation as a good example of their investment, and make trade-off decisions about capital cost, operating cost, quality, as well as the other planetary boundaries. And what we're finding is a lot of these things are really instrumental for decision-making. If you don't know what the trade-offs of these things are, then you generally don't make good decisions about them. And so what we're also finding is that there's a lot of symmetry between good decisions, sustainably good decisions, as well as economic decisions, particularly in the real world. So I've talked a little bit about carbon. I've also talked a little bit about planetary boundaries, and I'm going to step you through one example that we're working through with our colleagues at Planet Price. So this is a real project in Samoa, very impacted by climate change, very impacted by decarb as a good example. So Project X, I won't give you its name, two design options. And you can see these are the elements, the magnitude of the planetary boundary. So if you were to do this project, this is the social cost that is rarely capitalised, as a good example. But what you can see here, from design option one to design option two, in real time, we are able to absolutely reduce the social cost, the planet cost of this investment before we've even turned to put a shovel in the ground. And if you monetize, say, $42 US a ton for concrete and then make some assumptions about the other planetary boundaries, that is a social cost that we're able to quantify. So you sort of are setting up a social bank account to create change, effectively. And we're able to reduce that by 54%, that someone, maybe not the asset owner, has to pay, i.e. society in the future. So it's, as Andrew just highlighted, it's not just us, it's not just engineering, it's not just policymakers, it's not just structured finance, it's not just consumers, it's everyone working together. But there's a massive size of the prize here if we get this right. And it's highly exportable, I hasten to add. The tools, bottom-up, automatic, are available now, but we just don't routinely use them, and they're just not routinely demanded for lack of a better word. So hopefully that brokers a good conversation about the panel, and thanks for the time, and thanks for making the time to talk to us.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks heaps, Tim, for that. It's been really exciting for us. We've heard a lot about collaboration over the last couple of days, and I would encourage those of you to look around you and see who can you partner. If you don't have all the skills and the techniques that you need to solve a problem, well, then go find somebody to collaborate with. So we've really, really enjoyed the collaboration that we've undertaken with Becca. So next, I'm going to invite the panel members to come up and join me on the stage. I've got Michael Pooley. Have I got that right?
Close enough.
Who is Director of Sustainable Finance at ING Bank. We've got Jerry McMahon, who's Partner of Climate Change and Sustainability Services at KPMG. And we've got Christina Tonkin, who is MD of Corporate Finance for ANZ. So I will just grab my glasses. I strongly encourage you to go and look at the bios. We're not going to go through them now. a little bit about the format. I'm going to ask each of the panel to give us about 3 minutes of a quick overview or some insights or some key things that they're seeing in their market, in the conversations with clients. And then I'm going to we'll take some questions. I've got a question for each of the panel. But once we've got through that, I strongly encourage you to get on the app and flick through any questions that you've got in mind. And we will take it from there and see what we've got left at the end. So, Christina, if you want to kick things off.
Excellent. Well, it's absolutely brilliant to be here today in Melbourne. And I do want to congratulate the ACE Hub for putting on, you know, an excellent conference, which is covering all the different industries and providing the latest innovation in Australia and what's happening in the circular economy. I think, as Andrew said, you know, the banking sector finances the economy. And, of course, the challenge here is how we're going to finance and drive a circular economy. And I do want to start on a positive note because I do feel that we're really at a tipping point and that there's a golden opportunity over the next few years to really accelerate what is happening across areas, whether you're talking about energy transition, industry decarbonisation, nature and nature-positive solutions, and indeed, of course, where does circularity fit into that as one of the really, I think, key economic platforms of how we transition, not only in this country, but globally. Of course, Australia has a very strong banking system, and that is, of course, a very good place to start. Not only do you have the large commercial Australian banks, but you have upwards really of 200 either foreign banks here or non-banking participants that are financing at the moment. And I think it's both an individual journey in the banking sector and a collective journey. So I will talk a little bit about both. For ANZ, we have a purpose to shape a world where people and communities thrive. We came out with that strategy a number of years ago. A pillar of that is across three areas that we're focusing on. Working with our customers around how do they drive environmental sustainability in their businesses at scale. Financial well-being of households and also housing and housing affordability. For those that follow the banking sector, we reported last Monday. And so I'd invite everybody to go to anz.com and to our shareholder site. And you've got several hundred pages there of what we're doing across each of those different areas. How we're tracking against our targets as part of the Net Zero Banking Alliance, and we've announced a number of new pathways. How we're tracking against our $100 billion target by 2030, working with our customers, particularly around decarbonisation, how our own footprint has been moving to reduce Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. Then talking more broadly on the banking sector, and I think this is very important. Maybe some of you in here have heard of the Australian Sustainable Finance Institute. That started pre-pandemic. And, of course, that brings together the banking sector, the insurance sector and the investor sector. And they've been charged more recently by Federal Treasury to develop the Australian Sustainable Finance Taxonomy. And some of that work has come out already and some of it will be coming out. Again, that's very important because, of course, Australia, like a lot of countries, is quite unique. And we need to come up with different financing standards that will be suitable for driving both, you know, decarbonisation but energy transition in a just manner in Australia. And I do feel it's an excellent way that the circular economy family can link in. Again, for ANZ, we've got three, you know, innovative platforms that we've been working on this year. With the Energy Efficiency Council, we financed a Forgotten Fuel series, which we're taking out to our commercial customers and our large customers and planning also to our retail customers on how you can drive practical energy efficiency. We took an investment last year in Pollination Group, which is a boutique nature positive ESG advisor and fund investor, and we're using them to effectively take strategic advice to our customers and also to engage our bankers. And of course, it would be remiss of me not to mention that I've just been fortunate enough to be asked to be on the advisory board for the ACE Hub. So I'm looking forward to connecting with that going forward.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Christine. Okay, over to you, Jerry.
Thanks, Debbie. So my team at KPMG is a climate change and sustainability services team, and we work with clients across all sectors on everything from ESG reporting and assurance, although I'm not an auditor, I've told everyone before this, to responsible investment and sustainable finance. And I work primarily with the asset and wealth management sector. I love working with that sector, so that's asset owners like super funds and pension funds and investment managers, because I think it's such a privilege to be in a position to be able to influence how and, you know, where money is invested, millions, sometimes billions of dollars, and to be able to use your influence and as an investor to advocate for positive change. So I've actually been back in Australia for nearly a year now, but prior to that I was working in London for the last 13 years. And I spent the last 5 years working with UK pension scheme trustees, advising them on how to invest more sustainably. And over the last 5 years, I've seen a shift in the way they approach ESG investing, if you'll call it that. So to initially sort of looking at it as, in terms of the risk mitigation, taking account of financially material risks, to starting to see the opportunities of taking account of ESG factors, to eventually starting to allocate to impact investments. And Andrew mentioned the GIIN, the Global Impact Investing Network, in his keynote earlier. So that's been a huge shift over the last 5 years over in the UK, and we've seen that in Europe as well. But probably the biggest change I've seen has been the increase in corporate engagement on environmental and social issues. So engaging with the funds and the companies they're invested in directly on ENS issues. So they started off with climate change, obviously, moved across to nature, to expand to nature, and then human rights and other S issues. But it's only been in the last 12 to 18 months, really, that they've started to focus their attention on circular economy. So it is still early days, but, you know, this is where the focus has to be here from the asset owners, the super funds, the pension funds, because they're at the top of the investment chain and everything flows down from there. And as you've seen with movements such as Climate Action 100+, when pension funds get together and decide that something matters, it really matters because they have that much influence. So that's the perspective I'm hoping to bring to our discussion today, the institutional investor perspective based on the number of clients I work with in that space.
Awesome. I found it really intriguing. One of the, I think it was the Norwegian pension fund pulled out of, was it Walmart? Or I can't remember the exact details, but I do think they're starting to wield those levers at their disposal. So I agree, those big institutional investors have an amplified effect when they pull that
lever. We've heard all about collaboration across the last 2 days, and it's when they get together actually and start using their
real
collective
power.
Influence that things start to shift.
Sounds good. Michael.
Wonderful. I don't think I'm going to take my 3 minutes. So
that's okay. More time for questions.
Oh, good.
Essentially, people ask me what I do at ING, and that's giving money to corporates who are really trying to make environmental and social improvements to what they do. And so really what we do when we're looking at these corporates is to ensure they say what they mean and they do what they say. And so that's very important for ING, our reputation, and also trying to genuinely push some of this transition for positive change. One of the interesting things that I've noticed over time is that with enhanced data accuracy, banks and other players, stakeholders in the market have become more surgical. I think back in the day it was more just feeling around blind, trying to... a bit woolly, trying to go in the right direction, but the direction was out here, and now it slowly starts to be tapered in. And I think, I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole of greenwashing, but what I will say is that these accusations, these regulatory oversight of such things has really made the industry take a bit of a pause a breather to say, hang on a sec. We were traditionally being pushed ESG, and maybe we weren't wanting to do it, and it was coming down from the board. So we kind of begrudgingly pushed it, but it resulted in a lot of issues, you know, a number of years down the line. And so I think with these accusations of greenwashing, there's been a pause to say, actually, we should have the data today to back up our claims for tomorrow.
Okay.
And I think that's very important in the industry at the moment.
Cool. Awesome. I had a little reflection this morning, and I think a few people, for those of you who've been to other sessions, I hear the circularity gap report and the circularity of the global economy has dropped from 9.25 to 7.9. Please don't quote me on those exact numbers. But I wonder, is it really true that we're trending in the wrong direction, or just we're getting better at refining the granularity of the data, and that the underlying circularity is not necessarily trending in the wrong direction, but actually we're getting better granularity over the data, so it looks. And I think that's one of the challenges we might see. We get better at counting carbon. People have done their baselines. They redo them in 2-3 years, and oh, God, that's totally in the wrong direction. But actually, their scope threes are now in a way that they weren't before. So I do think data is critically important to this conversation going forward. So I've got a couple of questions that you guys provided. So I'm going to start with you, Jerry. How are institutional investors assessing or implementing an assessment of circular credentials of companies that they're considering investing in? Like, how are they doing this?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, it's still very early days in Australia. So the short answer to the question is probably that not many asset owners and asset managers in Australia are. But, you know, it's starting to change. They're starting to call this out as a key area of focus for them and start to move on it. Of course, there are asset owners, asset managers who have been doing this, but they'll be the ones who have a heritage of sustainability or impact investing. And I think, you know, but, you know, what's really encouraging to see is that globally, and particularly in Europe, there's been an explosion actually in funds that are targeting investments in circular solutions. And they will have gone through this process of, you know, getting the buy-in internally by getting everyone to understand what the value is from investing in this, because that's what they're there for, to deliver a financial return. So if it doesn't stack up on that, then they're not gonna do it. And then secondly, starting to screen for circularity, you know, within their portfolio. And that can be as basic as just starting to ask the question, you know, do you have any circular strategies or initiatives in your company? And that does sound very basic, but asking a question about it is better than not asking a question at all.
It's and a signal, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then finally, starting to increase the allocation of investment in the companies that have, you know, a higher maturity in this area.
Sure.
And so I guess those are the steps. And I do think this is going to be a really big topic for responsible and sustainable investors over the next few years. And we are going to see more public advocacy on it, like we've seen with Climate Action 100+. You know, Nature Action 100+ was recently launched. Perhaps on this panel next year, we'll be talking about Circular Action 100+ and how that's just been launched.
I love that.
Yep. And increasingly it's going to become a focus as investors realize that this isn't just another ESG issue. It's actually a solution to so many of the ESG issues they're already trying to tackle.
Sure. Awesome. So, Michael, I just want to talk some of the language that we hear, system change, circular economy. It's quite new to business leaders. It's still fairly nascent to many of them, particularly in Australia. So how do we focus less on risk and look a little bit more at ambition and productivity?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, from a bank's perspective, risk is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's really important, because we've really got one promise that we're making, and that's paying back depositors on time and in full. So don't lose depositor money is the reason. So as a consequence, highly regulated, the risk management is the core focus of the bank. And I think, you know, when I look at a bank, it's really a relationship based on trust. And I think what feeds into that trust is that societal expectation is that the banks are actually engaging on environmental and social impacts, impacting the society that they operate in. And so it's really trying to tackle that risk first. And I think, how do we convince banks that something's less risky than what it appears on face value? And I think one of the key crutches that banks use is verified data.
Okay.
So talking about KPMG, hence the joke about an auditor. I think you've got colleagues perhaps in the other room who are trying
She's on stage right now in the other room.
If I could be in two places at once, I'd definitely be in the other room as well. And so essentially, if we can get some verified data, you walk up to the bank and you say, this is what we're promising as a company, as a corporate or a startup. This is our commitment, and this is the degree we've got some control over that, that destiny, that commitment. Banks love you.
Okay.
And so I think that settling the risk, which has to be addressed, opens up the opportunities.
Gotcha.
And so when it comes to financing the circular economy, the topic of this, when I look around, ING's got $125 billion per annum commitment by 2025 to go towards sustainable financing. We've got ANZ, $100 billion by 2030. We've got CBA, $70 billion. So it's not really a contest, but I'm just flagging that there is a lot of cash out in the market ready to be deployed as soon as you've got some audited, verifiable data and you've got control. And so that's the point in which the opportunities are maximised.
Awesome. That's really good. So, Christina, I'm just curious on your thoughts of what are the role of specialist industries and organisations like Ace Hub and Circularity, what role do they play in supporting the transition of businesses more generally and the likes of the financial sector who have to shift their thinking?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do fundamentally believe, and it's certainly been part of the strategy for the corporate finance business that I run, in the business of partnering and partnering with what I would call peak industry bodies. I think particularly banks are intermediaries.
Yeah.
So in terms of not just, yes, we have, you know, a very powerful customer base and we work with those customers, but driving these conversations across the sector at all different levels is kind of very important. So peak industry bodies, whether we've been speaking about, you know, the Australian Water Association, the Green Buildings Council, the Energy Efficiency Council, the Carbon Market Institute, has been, I think, a very effective way to drive, you know, the best in-class innovation, what is happening in the industry. And certainly every time I come to an event like this, you know, you learn something new that you can take back and think, well, how do I amplify that through the 40,000 people that work at ANZ and service customers? And as I said, you know, and it's particularly clear when you've been engaged in, you know, initiatives like ASFI, which really cover banks, insurance and investors, and you'd think we all speak the same language, but we simply don't. So getting this sort of common language, common taxonomy, common standardisation, that is mean that we'll get, you know, won't be going down that spiral of greenwashing versus green hushing is going to be quite important for us. I think the other area is in terms of driving innovation. And of course, we have a very, you know, comprehensive university sector, and a lot of the solutions, whether we're talking about land management or recycling or materials design, is sitting in the university sector in this country and in the PhDs students. And it's how do you kind of unlock that into small, medium and large enterprise? And I do think that gatherings and peak industry bodies have a very important role in driving that.
There's got a couple of really good questions coming through, and one of them I think is quite topical because we've seen the introduction of TCFD and now we've seen TNFD, and is the introduction of these mandatory disclosure frameworks and the fines applied for greenwashing, is that going to start to shift capital into more responsible investing and circular industries more generally? Do you think that will make a difference? What are you seeing?
Who wants to go first?
Jerry.
I would love to take this.
I thought you might.
Yeah. So over in the UK, over the last 5 years, there's been a regulatory explosion in this space for institutional investors. So every year since 2019, UK pension funds have had to disclose on another ESG thing every single year.
Wow.
And as of 2 years ago, every pension fund with more than £1 billion in assets now has to do an annual TCFD report. So there's no mandatory climate reporting here for anyone yet. And it's not going to be TCFD when it comes, and it's going to be ISSB.
Okay.
But in the UK, they'll have to do it now. And, you know, large listed companies, and they all have to do it. Because of everything that's come in, requiring them to disclose on this, that, and the other thing, ESG thing, that has driven a huge shift in attitude and approach towards responsible investing, and, you know, that I described when I was in my intro. So going from responsible investor to looking at the risk side, to going to sustainable investor, to looking at the opportunities, and then to impact investor. So I would say absolutely yes. I don't think this would all have happened without all of that regulatory intervention. And I think, you know, our taxonomy here can't come quickly enough, because that's going to help with the greenwashing side of things. But ultimately, you know, in 2 years' time, a lot of institutions are going to have to start doing this reporting, and I really think it's going to drive a lot of change.
Cool. Yep. Awesome. I've got a little bit more of a granular, it may seem simpler, but I've seen this repeatedly in the work that I've done in local governments and communities, where they've got these great ideas, tool libraries, repair cafes, and there is almost an impossibility for them to gain funding because it doesn't fit into a standard model. It's got much longer time frames, you know, so it doesn't fit the way we typically invest in things. And how do we build community wealth building as a conversation, as part of allowing those smaller? We've got great microfinance opportunities we've seen in Asia. What are we doing to support small businesses like that in Australia? What's ING doing,
what's
Michael?
What's ING doing? Okay, well, my ambit is the wholesale bank, so I look at generally larger companies.
Sure.
So I think with the tool library, I'd be interested to see how they do fund themselves, whereas through philanthropic donations or perhaps the local
council. A lot of
council,
it's councils, yeah.
Right? Fully supportive of those kind of actions. From kind of my perspective, and I'm one of these 10,000 feet in the air kind of people just with the size of companies that I look at. But it prompts the question as to what degree do the councils get together and say, we're going to roll out tool libraries across the state, across the country, if they can agree, and create such volume where it does become a bankable size. And I think that would be a question that I'd pose to them.
So they need scale, and to collaborate to get scale to come with a proposal.
Exactly. And I'll just quickly add to that. I was talking just yesterday to some people with a pitch session. And really it's a question as to, we've got governments giving lots of grants to lots of companies. They're doing their due diligence on those grants. To what degree, just an idea of, you could collate a lot of these grants into a pool, and then suddenly the government's got the equity risk because they've got the grant money, and then you can bank the rest of it. You can get a loan. So pooling together to get bankable size, I think, is important.
Okay. Well, that's a really good idea. We don't have too much longer left, so I just want to pose the same question to all of you. In light of what Jerry has told us, and we've heard about the EU driving that notion around, and the narrative pricing externalities, planetary boundaries, metrics move markets, I heard that repeatedly while I was in Europe. How do we get the finance and business sectors ready for the data and the metrics that they need? I mean, we at Planet Price have done some analysis of billions of dollars and spend lines and lines, and some of it's in massive big buckets with one line item. So the linear economy has asked its questions for a few hundred years. Now we're asking it different questions, and the data isn't set up to get those insights out. So what can we do to support businesses and the finance sector to improve that? Christina?
Well, I think that's the sort of $64 million question. And you know, data is really quite a journey. And I would definitely say in the finance sector, and having just been through our reporting season where we've been disclosing under TCFD and disclosing, you know, what we've been doing in our $100 billion $100 billion target, you are finding, and I'm quite sure this is the case in a lot of banks, that you're on this journey from traditionally having... Banks have traditionally credit risk-weighted their books, and they've done that for a long period of time, and they've been able to have their systems and everything built around that. And then I think you had that journey into really operational risk, where there's been a lot of focus on operational risk, how do you measure operational risk, etc. Now, of course, it's how do you have the systems internally to effectively carbon weight your book for what is a better example and what are your financed emissions. And then, of course, you're working with your customers as well. And, of course, this is one of the challenges. If it's challenging for large entities, large banks, large superannuation, large corporates, irrespective of what sector they're working in, I think, you know, you're particularly going to see this rolling out in Australia over the next few years under the safeguard mechanism, which, of course, is picking up, you know, a wider role of entities. And this data challenge is going to be quite the thing to solve. Of course, I'm a positive person, and having a challenge there with a lot of great intellectual minds that we have, not just in this room and in the broader community, I think the answers are out there. And it's really partnering, and indeed organisations like ACE Hub that help drive that best in class for what is bespoke for this geography and our rules and regulations, whether you're talking local council to state to federal, it is quite unique.
Yeah. 30 seconds, Jerry.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk from the investor perspective. What do they need to do to push this along? They need to start screening for it.
Okay.
They need to start screening for it in the companies they are invested in and screening in, so investing in companies working on circular solutions.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And Michael?
I would probably take a slightly different perspective and say be careful what you wish for.
Drowning in data.
If you look at data that's being collected by the Reserve Bank, by APRA, by Australia, the ABA, you know, any organisation, it's never perfect and it's always revised. And so we've got to be very selective on what we're getting from that data before we just shove it onto companies.
Yeah, fair enough. Just before we wrap up, thank you for the fantastic feedback. I've got some really good ideas now that I need to, you know, process those when I'm done. But we were chatting on a call a few weeks ago, and I heard repeatedly 2024 is going to be the year of circularity in Australia. And I just want to take that note away, because expect big things. And if you would join me in thanking the panel and giving them a round of applause for those insights they've provided today.